Hey, you're listening to Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. We broadcast from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Hunkamina-speaking Musqueam people. My name is Josh. You are listening to Textbook. This is a show here on CITR about student issues and about stories and stuff. We have a pretty weird and wild show for you guys today. We're starting off with some readers from the Garden of Statuary and talk a little bit about that publication, which is the English Undergraduates Journal here at UBC. Then we have a story from Austin Zeller, who is a student exec here at CITR. And finally, we have a paper talk, Tell Me About Your Paper, with Roisin, who's going to be talking about Athenian marriage. So it's gonna be pretty mixed bag today. So first, though, Garden Statuary. It's that season where all the student academic journals are coming out. I'm really excited about the Garden Statuary. Do you guys want to just introduce yourselves? Tell us a little bit about the journal.
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm Esther. And I'm an editor at the Garden Statuary. And currently we are looking for submissions for our thing. So we're taking poetry, prose, academic essays, and visual art, and it'll be on February 17th. That's the deadline. So we're looking for submissions if you want to do that.
Oh, and my name's Afid. I've gotten published at the Garden Statuary a few times, but yeah, I'm here to read.
Cool. Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate you two being here. I guess we can just go ahead with the readings first, if that's okay with you folks, and then we can talk a little bit about the journal after. But yeah, let's start with the reading. Do you want to go first, Reed?
Sure. Do you want me to preface this?
Or yeah, please. That'd be great.
So when I wrote this poem, it didn't have a title. When I sent it into the Garden Statuary, I named it. I called it Feather Tip, and it's about sort of back home and writing about back home in English, which isn't my native language, and about how sort of I felt that people received my writing back home, given that I wrote in sort of a foreign language. So, yeah, it's a poem. I've written about my people before, and then I've heard them call back, your people. Who now gave you our voices? You lived in a home made of foreign paper with foreign walls. Your sweet nothings are whispered in the words that took the infant letters from our language. And your poetry wears the skin we were taught to fear. Aren't you a privileged little songbird? And even if your courage to write is as expansive as the ocean that divides your pen from our blood, your voice from our nation, even if you can imagine half the reality you did not see, and the other half you sculpted out of this black marble, you cannot be one of us. See, I have a fear of good words losing themselves in our languages. I believe that we choose to make our lifetimes last in the most convenient of voices. And my people will say I am fallen because Bangla is the fires of our martyrs. We who weave ink to taste of spice and saffron and family and to dance between blades of golden rice and our hands run through coarse jute kisses. Back home, our voices are proud and many and strong. In English, we find our tongues healed and our forefathers mute. Our gold like pyrite judged hollow. I hear them say, songbird, you are as different as the ink wetting your fingers from us, you are foreign. When we slaved and sweat and stirred restless, where were you? And our teeth quivered from their teeth quivered and our throats were parched from their dry, lifeless words. Why did you sing for them? And when we bled, which hallowed branch led you to stray to us to drink? And can anyone say that they were just afraid then and now? That among their people, they were the mute, he who barely holds on to the songs their grandparents whispered them to sleep. Their clipped wings wrote their stories. They are the ones who dared songbirds to flight. And so I say now, when I slaved, when you slaved, I watched. When you gasped for water, I drank our red sunsets. And now when I sing, I use their words, but your ink, their voices, and your songs. their lips for us to sip. And now when I stray into your hands, and let them run over coarse, muddied feathers. And I choose to make my people's lifetimes last in the voice that I have chosen.
Wow, thank you so much. That was incredible. Thank you so much. Is there anything you want to add about that? I mean, you gave a really good context at the beginning, a little bit about that. This was published in last year's issue, or is this the upcoming issue?
The most recent one, the spring
edition? Issue. Yeah.
The upcoming one.
Yeah, the upcoming.
And how long have you been writing poetry?
For a while. It was because my third grade teacher sort of like patronized me when I wrote this like poem of my cat, and she was like, "Yeah, this is very good." And I took it to my parents. They were like, "Mom, look, my teacher said something nice about me." And then they were like, "Yeah, okay." And then from then on, I've sort of been trying to write and mm-hmm. been going.
Are you, how do you find it balances or works off of your academic work in English? I've taken a seminar course with you
right.
before, so.
I find that a lot of what I'm learning in these English courses contribute to how my poems turn out, because really writing from back home, I had such a sort of restrictive perspective, and mm-hmm. coming here, it's opened up a lot of avenues for me to pursue mm-hmm. topics to pursue in terms of writing poetry. I'm very grateful for that.
And how long have you been gone
from home?
Yeah.
I moved here in 2014, so 3 years almost.
3 years.
I mean, I visit, but
mm-hmm. was it immediately that you started to feel like how was that kind of progression for you over the past 3 years?
In terms of writing?
In terms of writing and in terms of feeling disconnected.
Well, see, back home, I'm like one of many in terms of like how I look, how I talk. I come from a privileged family, but when I walk in the streets, you can't really tell. And here, like I really am aware of how different I look, even though it is a very diverse city. But you become aware that this isn't your homeland, this isn't your country, your family isn't here. And I think first year really hit me, and then second year it developed, and mm-hmm. we're here now. And I think I'm more at terms with it, but it's sort of always in the back of my mind, and so it manifests sometimes in writing.
Mm-hmm. Fita, I had no idea you wrote poetry, so it was an absolute pleasure hearing that today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Do you want to go on with the next
reading?
Sure,
yeah. Can I read a few poems?
I've got yeah, please.
Yeah, okay. I will preface this by saying this first one, wrote it while watching The Bachelor. It was, that is all I'm going to say. It's called Watching The Bachelor, 8:42 p.m. How many kinds of women are there? 16, all that are now left, one for every waking hour of the day, one for every kind of dress. My ballet teacher was one kind, used to measure us during warm-ups, the scale designed to dissuade us from being in excess. But it just fueled our distaste for the biggest among us, a certain kind, sticking out tongues before noticing what kind of woman we were or were becoming. Meanwhile, on screen, two women swear never to turn on one another, despite growing tension as Nick reveals his past with Liz. Last year, I served coffee to men that winked while handing me change. I laughed at jokes that made me itch because I thought no one else would. But there is that laughing kind of woman. Corinne from Miami licks candy-colored lips, while Taylor from Seattle bats bright cat eyes, open then shut. Later in the night, a rose will be given to a rose-receiving kind of woman, and the others will stand in line still and wonder what kind of woman they are. So that's that one. This next one, I wrote it a while back for a workshop in like 200. It's called The Internet is So Big It Swallows Me. Is there any way I can eliminate all self-doubting phrases and unnecessary approximations from my vocabulary without coming across as inaccessible? Please advise. I got to my first class late this morning because I fell into my mirror and forgot briefly how to get out. I have tried on 5 outfits. In therapy, they mostly blame your problems on the things you tell yourself when it's late and no one is online anymore. My Facebook status last night stating, my best yoga pose is the downward spiral, got 44 likes and 0 inbox messages. Every time you left, I took a picture of the sky and hung it on the wall. In elementary school, a friend of mine told me she'd see me tomorrow and never came back. When my chain-smoking neighbor tells stories about his weekend, he always says, "I couldn't make this stuff up. I accept this as a somber confession and turn away." And I've got one last one. It's called Weightless. I wrote this one for this workshop last term. Yeah, so Weightless. Facing the wall, he peels his shirt off in the dark. I'm 16, and it is common fact that you do not call boys beautiful, so I do not say the word beautiful. I just think it really hard. I hide my face under the covers. I'm 8, and the family down the hall is asking me over to play, but I run back to my apartment because I know that their toys are fancier than mine, and what if my toys find out and feel sad because I left them for better ones? I'm 13 in a bathroom stall at school, and a girl is throwing up in the stall next to mine. I ask if she's okay. I'm 12, and a boy calls me fat. I'm 7, and my mom tells me I'm not the baby of the family anymore. I'm 16, and he sits nervously on the edge of my bed, but I do not feel nervous. I'm 9 at camp, and all my friends are staring into the sky. I miss seeing a shooting star, but get excited with everyone else. I'm good at feigning emotion. I'm 13, and my best friend tells me I look pretty. I'm 20, and I tell myself I look pretty. I'm 11, and I eat a cupcake. I'm 15, and writing his name over and over in the back of books I like. I'm 14, and standing on the bathroom scale in the morning before school, when Fit Body magazine says I should be thinnest. I'm 20 in a bathroom stall, and a girl is throwing up in the stall next to mine. I don't ask. I'm 6 wearing flashy light-up shoes. I'm 19 throwing a forehand flick up the field. I'm 4 on my first flight on the first plane ever, and when we take off, I feel the lift in my body, and I'm weightless, and I'm flying, and I don't care about anything else.
Thank you so much.
No problem.
So a couple of those were written in workshop.
Yeah.
You mentioned. How's that process been for you?
It's been really fun. I just started in the creative writing program. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's been really cool having those small classes and just being able to discuss and hear people's feedback on your work.
Yeah, that must be really nice.
Yeah, it's really cool.
And I think even different than editing you might get with a publication where there's that kind of written back and forth, but when it's an oral and kind of a presence too.
Yeah, and it's like a discussion. You get to sit down on it.
I wanted to take it back to the first poem briefly too, with reality TV and writing while you're watching TV, which I think is actually a really interesting thing. It's a really interesting kind of practice to do. Mm-hmm. What do you find it is about writing when you're watching TV? Like, what prompted you? I mean, other than the content, but what prompted you to like start writing while you're watching TV?
Honestly, I think it was just the weirdness of that show really hit me while I was watching it. I'm just like, there's this feeling where you're like, I don't really want to watch this show, but I'm watching it and I can't stop. And I just thought that it was so interesting, and I just decided to write about it, and then it turned into a poem. And yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's something really funny about that kind of multitasking and like,
yeah.
And then you're kind of like, yeah, when you kind of like assume the position of observer all of a sudden when you have a pen in front of you too.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to also ask who are you reading? Who are your influences with your writing?
I'm really liking Kate Monica. She's a writer in the States, and she's pretty young, but she's just kind of upcoming. She published a book recently, and I absolutely love it. Oh, I can't think of its name right now.
That's fine.
But yeah, I also really love Myra Gonzalez. She's a writer around here, and she's really cool too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that there's something really interesting kind of, I mean, it's been developing. This is not big news, but developing around like writing about the internet and writing back to the internet.
It's a big thing.
That's kind of an interesting thing. And I think, again, like, yeah, that kind of question of community maybe. Maybe a community that's a little bit more solid than the Bachelor community.
Yeah.
But yeah, that or where you can kind of share that and work off other people and mm-hmm. develop that. Yeah, thank you so much, both of you, for coming on and reading. I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
I guess you can submit to the Garden Statuary if you're interested in or pick it up. Is there any way that people pick it up? Do we know this at all?
Yeah. Should I talk?
Yeah, come in. We have somebody else in the room.
Hi, sorry. I'm the third person in the room. I've been sitting here for a bit. I'm Mary. I'm the editor-in-chief of the Garden Statuary this year. And so this is the Garden Statuary 6th year at UBC. It was founded by English undergraduate students. And so we accept work from any undergraduate student at UBC. Doesn't matter if you're an English major or an engineering major. If you have work that you'd like to publish, then you're welcome to send it to us. We mentioned earlier, we take anything from prose, we take poetry, we take multimedia, so drawings, we take photography, we also take academic essays in English. So whatever you have, throw it at us. We have our website at www.thegardenstatuary.com, so that's spelled thegardenstatuary.com. You can also contact us by email at thegardenstatuary@gmail.com. So that's spelled the same way. We'd really love to get submissions all across the board. We have a launch party at the end of the semester where we'll also compile all the things that were published in the first issue over the fall semester. And then this spring semester, it's going to get compiled into a print edition. So you get to be published by along with people like Afid that you heard speaking earlier, and you'll be edited by people like Esther that you also heard earlier. So send us your stuff.
Great. Thank you, all three of you, so much for coming in. I really appreciate it. That was really great. Everybody should check out the Garden Statuary. Cool. This is a Little Sprout. I'm going to just play a little song, Alien Boyfriend. Little Sprout just won Shindig on Friday. So, yeah, one to watch. Thank you so much. CITR 101.9 FM textbook.
What happened to you? You disappeared, and all that's left you, your eyeballs flickered in the middle of the room. Da-da-da. When you came.
This is Textbook, CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Josh. Next up is an interview with Austin Zeller that I did earlier today, a little pre-record while it was still bright and snowy out. It's about spiders and housing in Vancouver. So enjoy. Thank you so much. Austin Zeller. Austin is a... I'm here in the studio with Austin Zeller. Austin is a fourth-year forestry student. He is a member of the student exec. He's the promotions executive here at CITR. And he is a safety man, a trucker hat aficionado, and a senior housing consultant for Textbook.
Yes, yes. Thank you. Thank you, Josh. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. Austin is here to talk today about rodents and infestations. Tell me about the first, the most recent episode.
Yeah, so, a couple weeks ago, I finally killed the spider. So there was this big spider downstairs in the basement of our house that we're living in now. And it's about the size of a small child's fist. So it's a pretty big guy. And he's like a big black, just like...
Eight legs.
Scary, yeah. Scary guy. Some fangs, probably.
Oh, man.
Didn't really get close enough to see, but basically he lives in this hole underneath the stairs right next to my bedroom. And every time I vacuum, like, I accidentally bump his little hole and he scurries out. The first time it was quite a shock, and actually no, pretty much every time it was quite a shock.
It's like accompanied by a scream.
Yeah. It's a very like shrill shriek.
So your house here is in Kerrisdale.
Dunbar. Right? Yeah.
Dunbar. This one's in Dunbar, and you're living in the basement, and it's a carpeted basement.
Yeah, carpeted basement,
which is already weird.
Yeah, it is kind of weird. I've got this weird... It's actually... My room is, like, this really plush red velvet carpet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
no way.
It's pretty weird. And then, like, the actual basement is, like, is also red, but not as plush. So they...
Okay.
Yeah, it's weird.
These, like different plush levels of plushness.
Yeah, so pretty much, yeah.
Okay, so you're vacuuming here. You bump them the first time. The first time's bad.
Yeah, first time's bad. I didn't know. I wasn't expecting it, you know? Mm-hmm. And he scurries out of there. He hates the vacuum cleaner. He tries to attack it. He doesn't achieve anything.
Yeah. Because of the vacuum cleaner.
Yeah, neither do I, but...
Right. So, and then he kept coming back.
Yeah, he kept coming back. I kept, you know, bumping him as I was cleaning, and he'd come out. And then a couple times I was like, call all my buddies downstairs, you know, like, come see this big spider, you know? And he didn't come out. So I was like, he must be dead, you know? Uh-huh. And I kept seeing these other big spiders in different places, not as big, but, you know, fair decent size.
Maybe babies.
Yeah. So I was like, he must have.
In what other parts of the house? Like upstairs?
Upstairs and also like in the bathroom and, you know, just weird spots, corners of things. I was like, oh, he must have laid eggs, you know, and. These are the spawns, and so I went away from winter break and came back. I was cleaning the downstairs again and bumped it, and he came back out. So he was alive the whole time,
just
sitting there waiting for the vacuum cleaner again.
So what did you do?
That was the moment I was like, you know what? This is enough. I've had it up to here with the spider, and took out the little hose from the vacuum cleaner and sucked him up.
Oh, wow. You gave him the hose job,
too. Yeah, I gave him the hose.
Oh, my God. That's intense. That's a lot of suction.
Yeah. Hopefully, there's a chance he might have escaped the hose, but, like, I can't imagine him.
Yeah.
Like...
You couldn't have gotten away.
Yeah, there's no way. At least I hope not.
That is, man, the hose is strong, too. And, it's a shame because you're really just trying to clean your basement down there. Like,
Yeah.
Just trying to make the best of it.
I'm trying to do a good deed, and the spider is just wanting none of it.
Get out of there. What do you think he's feeding on? Probably like little bugs
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, there's actually like a weird of when we moved into this place, there was a weird amount of like dead roly polies, you know?
Oh, yeah, weird.
Yeah, they were just everywhere. And like we were sweeping, you know, like sweeping the upstairs, and you could just hear like it was sounded like change because their bodies are like made of these exoskeletons, right? You know, and like they're all like.
Yeah.
It was pretty gross.
The thing about those roly polies is that they're slightly like dirtier than like a lot of other. They're like dirty like clumps of dirt, you know? Like they're just like these little clumpy things that are just like you can sweep them up, but it's still gross as heck.
Yeah.
So tell me about before this house, what other kind of infestation stories have you encountered in the wilds of Vancouver?
Yeah, well, the place that I was living in my first and second year at UBC was totally infested with cockroaches. The first day I moved in, it was like there. I turned on the light at night and there was thousands of cockroaches on the floor.
Oh, my God. This was in your bedroom, in the bathroom? What room was it?
Well, yeah, it was in the kitchen, but my room was also in the kitchen.
Okay, great.
It was like kind of one of those pseudo rooms where you walled it off with a curtain. And,
okay.
Yeah, so it...
And they were just feasting.
Oh, yeah, they were just having a time of their lives. It was a house with seven guys, so it wasn't very clean to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And it probably didn't really help the cockroach situation at all. But
did you just go back to sleep after that?
Yeah, I was like, I don't know. I can't remember the first time I saw it. I was like, I don't think I slept very well. No.
Yeah. This was freaky.
But you kind of got used to it after a while. And yeah, I don't know.
Wait, explain this house a little bit to me some more, though. So you moved here first year, like right when you came to UBC, you moved to this house?
No, I lived in the dorms first year.
Okay.
But, and so, yeah. So it was just like a bunch of buddies and I.
So it was from the dorms to your second, the first like house you lived in.
Yeah.
And this one was where?
This one is like almost in Marpool, like the very edge of Carisdale.
Oh, and it was a big house.
The
rooms.
It was a pretty big house. Yeah.
Oh, unreal. Okay, tell me more. What were the kind of charms of this place?
Oh yeah, they had an attic area where two people lived in, but it was all like very shoddily done, and everything was made out of like this weird, like it wasn't quite plywood, but it was like the lowest grade of plywood you could make.
Oh, right.
You know, and yeah, it was an odd place. The downstairs, like. Our toilets would clog pretty much every day.
Oh, unreal.
And the downstairs, the, like, basement, people were living in there, too. Like, I think there was also, like, seven other people living in the basement. And it was a huge production that this guy was running, you know? And our toilets would clog, and the pipes would leak into the downstairs basement's kitchen.
Oh my God, that's horrible!
So like it was actually pretty gross.
Yeah,
it was a really gross place.
That's so bad. That's like way below like standards.
Yeah,
like that is probably illegal for that landlord too.
I bet it was. I bet it wasn't legal. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what was this landlord's deal? I mean, no, we don't need to slander on the radio here, as per CRTC. But tell me a little bit about this fellow.
Yeah, he was just like a. He seems like a normal dude, you know.
Yeah.
Just like, he seems like he's been doing this for a while, and
just
I don't know. I think he just kind of gave up on the house and was like, you know what? He called the exterminators a couple times.
He did.
Yeah,
that's good.
It was good, but like, they never went. The cockroaches never went away, and like at what some point we're like, would you rather have a bunch of cockroaches or like just a ton of chemicals? You know?
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, so yeah, like on par with that is mold, because mold is like an infestation, but it's also super chemical.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
What's your experience been like with mold?
Yeah, I've actually like, yeah. So this year, we ran into a really really sketchy situation with mold. A couple of my buddies, like only one of my buddies was in town, in Vancouver. over the summer, and we're looking for a place, you know, for the upcoming school year. So we were like, he was basically on the house hunt by himself, and he came across this house, and he like took it because it was the only one that he could, you know, basically find. And so me and my other roommate were like, all right, that's fine. Like, if you got it, then we're glad we're not homeless anymore.
Yeah.
But the first day we try to move in, and we noticed that one room, the whole place is infested with mold. It's just got that dank smell, you know?
Oh, man,
it's got that really moldy smell. And you got this, like, out in the yard, there's just, like, I don't know, just like a mattress out there. Like, it's been there for a bit. You know, you can see like there's like a small shrub that's pollinated this mattress. And it's like, and so we enter this basement, and it's just full of mold.
Yeah.
And we notice that there's this one room that has absolutely no windows in this basement, and it just smells like so bad. And,
oh man!
And the best part, we tried this experiment where we turned on off all the lights, and it's just total pitch black in this room, and it's like smelled like you're gonna die. And
oh my
and
god!
Then we noticed that you can lock it from the outside, so you could lock someone in this room with no windows.
Yeah.
It was so sketchy.
That is so terrifying. Yeah. Oh man! So wait, this is the place you live in now? You were just
no. We ended up getting out of it.
Because, okay. Like, how did you
totally
get out of it?
It's totally not legal to have a room without windows.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're just like, there's no way I'm doing this.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did that go?
Well, we filed a claim and everything.
Oh really?
Yeah. So, yeah.
Wow. Unreal.
We have a hearing in April or something.
Do you really?
Like that. Yeah.
So you broke the contract.
Yeah.
And just moved out. Did you even like move in the stuff? Was there like any?
I stayed at my girlfriend's place for that like couple weeks where we kind of were homeless.
Mm-hmm. That's such a stressful way to start school, too.
Yeah, it was. Luckily, we found the place that I'm living in right now.
Yeah.
Within like a week and or two. So it wasn't like a whole lot of.
Of that, yeah, that, like, middle ground where you don't know. So, like, this place, what neighborhood was this moldy place in?
It was close to Broadway.
Okay.
Like Broadway and Arbutus.
Broadway and Arbutus, okay. Yeah. I used to live, like, kind of around there,
too. Yeah, yeah.
And the landlord was, like, how was he taking it? He was just, like, absolutely not. You can't break contract or, like.
Yeah, well, I think, at first he was, like, nah, this is totally legal. Like, what are you
talking
about? Yeah. And then we started like sending him, like emailing him the documents that shows it's illegal.
Oh,
and then
wow.
He was like, okay. Like he starts to like kind of warm up.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, okay, I'll let you guys out of the contract. And so he lets us out.
Yeah.
But then he like keeps some of our money, you know?
Right.
And he's like, and so we're like, we want that money back, you know?
So you filed the claim, and did you have like immediately city people come to like inspect the house, or like
no,
how does it go?
No, I don't know. It's basically like, I think he admits that the room has no window.
Okay.
So basically, yeah, we're just kind of, he like submitted all these documents of like the place, I guess. And we kind of like submitted all of our like contact with him. In these documents, filed like a lot of paperwork, and then a lot of sitting in Burnaby, like waiting.
Oh my God! No way!
Yeah. So it was. Yeah, it's kind of, it's a rough process.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I've never actually heard anybody like go through all the way with
it. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's I mean, good for you guys.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
And everything, you're gonna get your stuff back.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, yeah. Like after like the last year of. You know, like living in a cockroach house, we're just so ready to like have a normal place.
Solid place just with spiders.
Yeah, just with spiders.
Just a couple spiders.
You know, spiders are okay.
Spiders are actually like in the grand scheme of things, spiders are pretty good. I mean, I'm curious about this mold though. Like, what kind of, are we talking like black mold or like fungus? Like are we talking like mushrooms from the walls?
No mushrooms. But yeah, it was Yeah, probably black mold. Yeah, like all the windows were kind of tinted with this kind of gray, black sort of stuff.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. And it was, yeah, there was some like kind of greeny corners.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God. And the smell sounds just horrible.
Yeah, pretty bad.
it's really hard to communicate smell over radio, too. That's something I've realized.
Yeah, yeah.
There's only certain words you can use for it, like pungent, you know? And then, like, I don't know, just, like, that kind of rotting or, like, anything that's, like, equivalent to a corpse. Like, it sounds like that room was kind of had that corpse smell.
Oh, yeah, totally, totally.
The
yeah.
dampness, too.
Yeah, very damp, very, like, sticky. Yeah.
Sticky, oh yeah. God, sticky mold. That's gross. And well, I'm so glad that you have a place now that you're living in.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's much better.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds like a good place. I'm really glad that you got this spider out of your hair.
Yeah, yeah, I am too.
Yeah,
I can now walk like without doing high knees to the washroom.
You can sleep easy.
Yeah,
that's good, man. I'm really glad, Austin. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Josh.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
It's great. It's too much for a cultural backwater like Vancouver. It just bursts with violence. It's got every absurdity and nihilism of the world.
CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Vancouver. Every absurdity and nihilism of the world since 1937.
It'll play off Broadway. I can see it now.
Hey, this is Textbook, CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard an interview with Austin Zeller. I'm here in the studio now with Roisin. Roisin, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, I'm Roisin. I'm studying at UBC. On an exchange year. I'm at the University of Edinburgh usually, but I'm from London.
Great. Yeah. And you were telling me before that for the first couple of years of your degree, you were actually doing classics.
Yeah, I was doing English Lit and classics as my joint honours, so it's like equally weighted.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm now, so I did that for the first 2 years and then I'm now just doing English Literature.
You dropped the classics.
I dropped the classics, yeah, which was a sad decision because I love classical art and classical literature. The actual content is great, but the actual academic subject wasn't really suited to me.
Mm-hmm. It's a little bit stiff.
Yeah, it's completely uncreative. There is no room for any creative license. You kind of just have to like sift through these massive amounts of information of, you know, this academic institution that has been established for like hundreds of years, and there is mm-hmm. kind of no, especially at a university like Edinburgh, which is really traditional, mm-hmm. there's kind of like no going out of those bounds, and it's just like very elitist in the way that if you do classical studies you're kind of like lower on the scale because you don't do Latin and Greek, and
wow,
it's just yeah it's
unreal. But with this paper that you've done,
yeah,
you pushed up against that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, in my reading I didn't quite get to actually say that in my paper because they don't really like any interpretation or any theory. It's just like, has to be facts, really.
Has to be cold, hard.
Cold, hard
pottery
facts.
Yeah. Why don't you start by describing this phase that you wrote about?
Okay, so the essay was that you had to kind of like analyze this image on a vase, which was, it's a lutrophos, which is a long-necked vase with two handles, and it's got an image of it on it of an Athenian wedding ceremony. It's from the 5th century BC from Athens, and basically it shows a woman who's veiled looking down. She's being unveiled by a female attendant, and looking at her opposite is a man who's the groom, and he's surrounded by his male attendants. And above them is the little figure of Eros, the personification of love, and he's giving her a gift. And then their male and female attendants are exchanging gifts of like fruit and wine.
Mm-hmm. And what was so interesting to you about this image?
Well, it basically shows a ceremony which is called the Anacalypteria, or also known as like Opteria, which basically shows this part of the wedding ceremony when the woman was unveiled to her new groom, because there's a lot of evidence to suggest that ancient Athens was actually a veiled society, like a similar to kind of purdah societies of today. So women wore a veil that was pretty similar to the niqab and the burqa today. And during this process, it was basically the first time that a high-class woman would basically ever leave the house apart from for a religious ceremony. And she would walk from her father's house or by cart with all her female attendants and the male members of the family to the groom's house. And she would be unveiled by her female attendants. And then the man would look at her and deem her acceptable or not acceptable. And then that would be like, that's basically the legal process of the marriage.
Wow. And so these little houses were where you would stay most of your time. What was that like? Like, what was life like living in two houses in your lifetime, from your own house to the husband's house? But just talk to me about that a little bit.
The houses actually gives us a lot of evidence for, because obviously in classics you have to, because it's such a long time ago, you have to take kind of like a lot of archaeological and architectural evidence. So like there's a lot of house plans, and basically the houses in ancient Athens were organized into a women's section and a men's section, the gynaikon and the andron. And it was like a self-contained unit, like a self-contained household pretty much. They had the women, the men, the slaves, the children, maybe like a farm or, you know, like produce inside it. And so the walls were really high, and it was designed basically so no one could see inside it, so that women couldn't be seen, especially, and women couldn't be seen from the men's part of the house. They would never go in there, really.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a theory that so this veil that women wore is kind of like an extension of that, or the house is a reflection of that veil, that women kind of carried this house on their backs. They were constantly housed within this veil that covered them, so no one could look into the house and see the women, and no one could look at a woman if she was in public and like compromise her modesty, which is like to protect mm-hmm. her honor, as pretty typical in a patriarchal society.
Mm-hmm. So the idea here is that the veil was just an extension, basically, where the veil was also controlled by the man, who would kind of just look and choose.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, at this moment where the woman was unveiled, it's kind of like, it's really heavily symbolic. And what you can kind of garner from these images is that in this moment where she's unveiled, she's kind of in a moment of flux, like her kind of chastity is in a moment of flux, because she's unveiled, she's essentially naked to the man's gaze. And he looks at her, and in that moment, it's like a penetrative gaze. It's like an erotic gaze, as symbolized in the image by Eros hanging above them. And then he accepts her, and that restores her honor. And then she's re-veiled in a kind of like symbolism of her moving to this new house. But also the veil was often dyed red, which is symbolic of obviously of the undressing, of the consummation of marriage, but also of the hymen, and which basically the god of marriage ceremony was called hymen, which is where that word comes from. And the wedding song that they would sing was the hymeneos. So I just think that's really interesting that they have this like bright red veil that was kind of like symbolically unveiled in this sort of like penetrative gaze.
Mm-hmm. It's like this direct analogy made between the gaze and like erotic penetration, like
yeah.
this very very explicit,
yeah,
which is just yeah it's
which is super interesting considering like how modest it is to veil a woman, and how anxious that is over the modesty of a woman. And that it kind of symbolizes how, especially in like typical patriarchal societies, how this the woman's body is this site of such anxiety and such honor, like, and a woman unveiled can compromise the entire honor of the household.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it sounds like there's this this moment too, I mean, at least from the picture on the vase here, is it's like a public moment too. It's like this public scrutiny where everybody's kind of assessing what's going on as well. Was it only the husband or the potential husband that was watching her be unveiled, or was everybody present? What were the kind of dynamics, the group dynamics there?
Well, all his male attendants would also be looking. So it's kind of like this horrible, daunting, mm-hmm. I would imagine, kind of like really degrading moment. And these, in ancient Athens, women who were married were, they were like prepubescent. So they were like 12 to 14. So really, really young, like children, basically, so as to not like compromise anyone's honor, really. So I imagine it would be really daunting. And there's one source that I was reading was talking about how Persephone was veiled on her way to the underworld to be married to Hades, which just like really struck a chord with me, because like a young child woman on the way to the underworld, to death, which is obviously, to men it would be to marriage and to ownership, it's like a part of the dowry process, mm-hmm. but to this woman like going to the underworld, I don't know, it makes me feel sorry for them.
Yeah, it's really violent.
Yeah, it is really violent. And I think it's just so interesting that this gaze is so overtly, you know, what we would call now like the penetrative male mm-hmm. gaze. It's like such an early depiction of that, and mm-hmm. it's so voyeuristic. And I read one article that was saying, because in ancient Greek like medicine, they believed that women and men had to be equally sexually aroused to like consummate a marriage, to like have a successful pregnancy. And so they were saying like this was an erotic look between the male and the female, as like symbolized by Eros flying above. But if you look at the picture, it's really she is looking down, and he is standing, she's sitting or kneeling, probably in supplication. And supplication's like in ancient Greece, if you knelt and put your arms around someone's knees, then you're in supplication, and they kind of like were inclined to do something for you. Mm-hmm. It's like lowering yourself. So it's like a plea, which mm-hmm. is kind of like she is in supplication, like pleading for her honor to be mm-hmm. restored. And he's standing above her, looking down at her. The male attendants are looking directly at her, and her female attendants are looking down. So I don't really buy that it's like an erotic stare between the two of them. Right. So it seems like the power dynamic is just so,
it's structurally there. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's like one of the most powerful things about that image is that, yeah, she's looking down. She doesn't, it's really, it's a really kind of honest depiction in a lot of ways, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think, also what I find really interesting, and to be honest, this is kind of just me thinking about it, I don't know how much evidence there is for this, mm-hmm. but the Lutrophos was like quite a specific vase, because like all the different vases in ancient Greece and ancient Athens had like very different purposes. So like a drinking cup, or like one to mix wine and water. But this one was either used as a funeral urn to be buried with an unmarried woman specifically, or as like prenuptial bathing ceremony. So you can kind of glean from that women would have been looking at this image, which is quite unusual, because usually, you know, heavily decorated pottery was used for male activities like prizes, or in the symposia, which like drinking parties, which are just men. So I think it's really interesting that, to me, that women would be looking at this very raw depiction of this penetrative gaze. And I was thinking about Laura Mulvey and the male gaze, and how she argues that women watching films or reading literature have to place themselves within the male gaze, looking at other women. Mm. And it's just really interesting to me that women would be looking at this image of the male gaze, but seeing themselves being looked at,
mm-hmm.
especially in a time when like you wouldn't see yourself depicted anywhere.
Right. And in this one instance, you would see it.
Yeah.
I think you referred to that before as kind of a preparedness, right? Kind of a preparation for it.
Yeah, I mean, I like to think so.
Yeah.
I may be projecting what I would want to see in this, but I don't know. It seems to me like, maybe a preparation for what's to come, as in the way that this gaze and this process is a preparation for like the consummation of a marriage and the movement from a woman from her father's house to mm-hmm. her husband's house and preparing. It's like this symbolic journey from like childhood and virginity, like the state of Parthenos, into like what would be motherhood, which mm-hmm. to us seems, you know, out of sorts because this girl would be 12, 13, right. 14, but.
Wow. I mean, yeah, really, really powerful image, really interesting yeah. analysis too.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for coming on today, Roisin. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
You have a song for us to choose. Roisin at 24 Hours of Student Power, which was two Thursdays ago. Hosted an hour of Grime 101, yeah. which was really sweet.
Classics in Grime.
Yeah, that's it. So what's the song that we have?
We've got Nadia Rose with Squad, which is, I think it was released last year. It's a recent Grime tune.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the leading ladies in Grime, one to watch. So a bit of female power after that conversation.
Textbook, CITR 101.9. Thank you so much, Roisin. Up next is Discorded Radio. CITR.
Guess who's back? But you never left. Yes, I did. I rose from the dead. And now I'm here to kill them with flows and some punchlines that'll go over your head. Turn back, I'm a portion ahead. I'm your worst nightmare, stood over your bed. So them girl try call me, but I smell defeat like a hole in your crap. Wow, she's sick and she's bad. She sings and she raps, she shit and she's whack. They talk all that chat, but when they see me, don't speak none of that. Cause nobody bad like me. I'm fucking higher than a block of flats in Battersea. Whoa. And I'm with my team. Squally, where you at, my jade? I'm rolling 10 gear up in that squad. That's what, that's squad. I'm only 10 gear up in that squad. That's what, that's squad. I'm only 10 gear up in that squad. Fucking with my squad? I think not. Me and my bitches, we roll deep and we always got green, so we pretty much peas in a pod. I was at the scene, had to flee from the cops. I go inside with no keys for the locks. Excuse me, madam, how did you get on the premises? Well, I came to kill off my nemesis, so I used my juju when I came up in the crevices. Them bitches say they're bad, but I'm from where the fucking devil is. So if they get me mad, we're in the yard, disturbing residents. And we leave out the yard, up in the car, disposed of evidence. Cause nobody bad like us.
Nobody bad like us.
But really, we don't want no fuck. Someone roll them blunt, so we can turn shit up. Squally, let me see you brush your guns. I'm rolling 10 gear up in that squad. That's what? That squad. I'm rolling 10 gear up in that squad. I'm rolling 10 gear up in that squaddy. Came true with the clan, came true with the posse. I came with Mary Jane's, I'm came in it with Molly. Nuff gear in it, that's the way you roll, squaddy. Nuff gear in it, that's the way you roll out. If the line's good, you have to get your phone out. Bare skin teeth when we pose for the photo. Some gear are braided, some gear are in cornrows. But still one dread if we have to. The heart is still like a statue. Been on my grind like my back tooth, yeah. Take out the time, but I fight zoots.
What else?
Step on the gas, take the back rooms. Why? Cause if my bitches need me there, well, I'm coming. And if I ain't got the witch, yeah, I'm running. I do it for him, it ain't nothing. Squally, hey, let me see you brush your son. I'm rolling 10 gear up in that squad. That's what? That squad. I'm rolling 10 gear up in that squad. That's what? That squad. I'm rolling 10 gear up in that squad. That's what? That squad. I'm rolling 10 gear up in that squad. That's what? That squad.